Hi and welcome back. This is Police Stories Podcast, episode 38. And today we're going to talk about close protection. This is a series of short stories about various incidents and jobs and how my sort of career progressed in the UK police force over 28 years. Today specifically close protection. If you need to go back and listen to a few episodes before, that might help in sort of figuring out where I'm at. But basically, I'd been a specialist firearms officer for a few years at this point. And as I've explained before, I was in a relatively small force, so you had to be able to adapt and wear several hats, if you like. You know, you couldn't just be, I'm a close protection officer, I'm a, you know, specialist firearms officer. You had to be able to do several of those roles. And I'd basically gone through my sort of firearms now, as most people did, you know, progressing through the various courses. And the final one to do really was the close protection course. So called different things in different countries, you know, bodyguards is how people like to think of it. Obviously, there was the sort of the famous film, The Bodyguard, you know, with Kevin Costner. And you know, that sort of brought perhaps the line of work to, you know, to the sort of public eye. But it's very, very different from the film, as most things are, you know. And private security and private sort of close protection and bodyguard work is very different from police close protection. Certainly in other countries, and particularly the States, they favour, and particularly the celebrities, you know, they favour kind of big, muscly bodyguards, be it male or female. And they're looking very much to put off anyone sort of trying anything on. They want this huge wall of, you know, big muscled people walking towards you to sort of put you off ever thinking that you try, you know, to attack that VIP. And we'll call them kind of VIPs from now on, whether they are or not in your eyes, you know, that's kind of the term for them. And so that's their aim. Whereas in the UK, we're very much more subtle, and protection is, a lot of our work is around designing out or planning out the issues that could happen. So rather than get ourselves into a big fight or a problem with a bad guy or girl, we'd rather plan it to a degree that that person has never had the opportunity to get close to our VIP. Now, the one thing I would say, and this comes up a lot, is that people imagine that they are now, you know, completely protected from every threat. I've got protection, I've got close protection officers with me, nothing can touch me. Well, again, you know, that isn't the case either. A protection officer is going to minimise an attack. They're almost certainly not going to be able to stop it. They might be able to, depending on the scenario. And we've seen that over the years, various times throughout the world. But the reality is, almost certainly, they're going to try and minimise that attack. You know, you may not be stabbed to death, but you may be stabbed, you know, once in a non-fatal injury. Now, that sounds horrendous. People will be like, what? I'm not signing up for that. You know, I'm paying for protection. I don't want to be stabbed, you know. But it's all about stopping you from being killed, ultimately. You know, and the sort of thing that comes out of that film and stuff is, you know, would you take a bullet for your VIP? Well, it's all about giving body cover. You know, if a threat presents itself, you put yourself between the threat and your VIP. So yes, there is a possibility that, you know, you will get stabbed or shot rather than your VIP. And that actually is your role. You know, if you've got a problem with that, then this probably isn't the course for you. So the course was run over 3 weeks at the headquarters that I was based at. It's a fantastic course, known to make you really, really paranoid. A very enjoyable course, very long days. It was kind of 12 to 15 hour days, you know, sort of 5, maybe 7 days a week sometimes, because there was a lot of planning that went on. And it started off very low level. We were taught initially, and so first day we were issued with two stupid hats. If you can imagine, you know, a 2 or 3 year old small sort of Billy Bunter hat with a propeller on the top, you know, and maybe, you know, a child's princess, you know, fascinator or hat or something. They were the two hats that the team was given. And always when we walked from the second we left the office in the morning to the end of the day, when we were on the headquarters sort of complex, which was a series of, you know, offices and a gym and a canteen and that sort of thing, but set over quite a big sort of acreage, if you like, the VIP, whoever was designated VIP that day, had to wear one of the hats. and the personal protection officer, which is the person that's closest to the VIP, had to wear the other silly hat. And the idea was that everyone who worked at headquarters knew who you were. They knew you were doing the course. They'd have been pre-warned, look, we've got a protection course running for the next 3 weeks. So you'll see a series of guys and girls wandering around headquarters. Two of them are wearing silly hats. And they'll have told the staff who they were. And in fact, what they did was they would put up staff to then approaching us with, you know, sort of ridiculous questions or sometimes very basic stuff. So they might speak to a member of staff and say, when you see the team coming, they'll be in a formation, they'll be in a sort of box formation, maybe there'd be like eight of them or something, two will have silly hats, try and walk straight to the person with the silly hat and ask them the time, you know. And obviously the whole idea was the team had to get used to moving as a formation around places. Sometimes there'd be sort of mock crowd set up that we'd have to deal with. But the idea was, yeah, the team got used to moving around in formation. And if somebody approached you, you know, you can't go slamming people to the ground and drawing handguns on them because they might be perfectly innocent, you know, and just want to speak to what could eventually be this, you know, member of the royal family or the prime minister or someone. You know, you can't go, you know, sort of smashing everyone that approaches them. So it's all about the subtleties and sort of dealing with stuff in a certain way. However, there may be a time where you have to do exactly that, depending on the sort of level of threat that's you know, offered by them. So time to time, you'd have people, you know, walking up to you and going, excuse me, can I, you know, can you tell me the time, please? And they're sort of quite set on getting to your VIP, and the team has to adapt and deal with them in a pleasant, professional way. And of course, now that the team is a little bit, not compromised, but, you know, put under pressure, other members of the team have to move up into those positions that are now empty because two officers are off dealing with this person who innocently has come to ask for the time. The group and the team and the VIP need to carry on moving, but obviously there's gaps now in the formation. So we got used to this moving around, but because you were liable to attack at any second and from any sort of quarter, it makes you massively paranoid. The second you stepped out of the office, you were fair game as a team. And you weren't safe until the moment you got to either the canteen or back in the office at the end of the day. And of course, they would engineer various things happening throughout the day. And it would start off very low level, you know, so it was, you know, this person that comes up and asks the time or whatever. But it slowly advanced into other lessons. So, for example, on one occasion, and we were forced, you know, to, right, we need you all to go to the canteen. Now, of course, they know that to get to the canteen, that means we've got 10 or 15 minutes where we're going to be very much on offer as a team and anything can happen, so they could engineer whatever they wanted. Now, people that worked around headquarters were quite used to this, and it wasn't unusual, and certainly on several occasions, you'd be walking as a formation and shots would suddenly be fired at you from a blank firing weapon, you know, off a nearby roof or something, and you had to deal with that. We were taught how to deal with it. A lot of it was about training your ears to identify which direction the sound had come from of the gunshots and kind of running in the opposite direction, but at the same time bundling your VIP with you and also giving that all important body cover where you put yourself between the gunman and your VIP. On another occasion, which was a particularly sneaky one which we liked, one of the instructors' wives was brought in, she put on a very, very short skirt and basically walked towards the team, which was, you know, kind of 80% men. So without a doubt, you know, they were a little bit distracted. For sure, all eyes were on her and probably not, you know, on the job in hand, which again was very much, you know, the aim. And she had a handbag with her and she sort of walked towards the team. And obviously we had to allow, you know, sort of normal people to come past. So the team would move over and allow her past. And as she got just beside the VIP, still with protection officers between her and the VIP, you know, she calmly reached into her handbag and dropped a hand grenade at our feet. And at the same time, one of the instructors threw a flashbang, you know, a stun grenade, so that there was this huge bang and explosion to simulate the grenade going off. And obviously, then we had to react. So some people had to sort of approach her. Some people had to, again, bundle the VIP away. So it was a fantastic course, really, really enjoyable. And it progressed on from there. Eventually, we went out into the public. There was a lot of driving involved. We were all advanced drivers at the time, but it progressed so that we were now driving and in sort of defensive formations when we were out. So people think you're cutting them up and all the rest of it. And basically, that's exactly what you are doing. But again, you're using your vehicle to block potential threats when you're turning out of junctions and when people are getting too close and things like that. There was lots of driving to routes. You'd have people doing advances, so they'd be driving ahead of your convoy to make sure there was no problems. And there was lots more going on. I won't go into massive detail for obvious reasons, but very, very enjoyable. And then it finished off with a retired firearms instructor was brought in to play our VIP for the last, I think it was 3 days of the course. And basically they said, you'll pick up this guy at this location at this time. And then for 3 days, 24 hours a day, we want you to protect him. And he's going to do a series of things and you just go with it. So we didn't have a lot of planning. We met him, you know, and that was fine. Now, don't forget that the actual person that only has contact with your VIP is the protection officer who is kind of sat in the car with them or has a discussion with them and perhaps over a coffee or something about what the day is going to bring. Now, in that VIP car, when they're travelling around, you're not sitting there, you know, on the radio or on the phone or anything like that. So if you haven't had the opportunity to quickly phone the team or speak to somebody on the radio, then what happens is you have an hour's journey and you might get in quickly, right, we're going to this seaside town and you know that's an hour's drive, say. You've now got an hour where you're sat in the back and in the VIP's car, you know, there's classical music on and it's all very calm and it's very much a swan moving across the surface of the water. On the surface, everything's calm and quiet and there's no chatter in that VIP car. But under the surface, you know, the legs are panicked and are, you know, thrashing away because there's a lot going on in the background. You've got people trying to get ahead of the convoy to be, you know, into any venue before you get there. And at the same time, one person, the sort of second in command, if you like, on the sort of protection team, the prop team, will be trying to interrogate via an earpiece the actual protection officer as to what's happening. So it's a series. Now, you would have a mic button on a sort of long wire that may be threaded down the sleeve of your suit, so that you're holding the pipper, if you like, to key up on the mic in your hand, or it might be threaded down in your trouser leg so that the pipper is in your pocket. And they will be asking you a series of questions. So they'll be saying, you know, but there are yes, no answers. And you can respond with a series of clicks on your mic. So it'll be, are we heading to such and such, you know, seaside town? One click for yes, two for no. So it's like click, they confirm back to you, yes, we are heading to so-and-so town. But it's got to be open questions, it's got to be closed questions. You know, you can do yes, no answers to. It's no good going, where are we going to? Because the person can't respond in that way. So remember, it's all calm and quiet in the VIP's car. So it'll be saying, are we going to a coffee shop? You know, click, one for yes. You know, are we going to meet someone? You know, two clicks, no. You know, and this is how it went on. So it was quite challenging, to say the least, and something, you know, you'd never been used to if you hadn't been in this role before. So for 3 days, we looked after this guy, and obviously he would make it difficult to us. So he would say, actually, I'm planning to go to the marina. I want to go to the marina, and I'm meeting a friend, and we're going to have a pizza in so-and-so shop. And you'd be like, oh, brilliant. So you'd send people ahead, and you'd scope out the area, and then, you know, you'd maybe approach the staff there and say, we've got someone coming in, because can we pick the tables? Because you're very keen to pick certain tables that are in a certain position and the protection team are between the entrance and the exit, you know, and your VIP is behind you in the corner so we can keep them safe, but we know where the fire exits are and how we get out and all these sorts of things. So you'd want to pick your table. And certainly I drive my wife mad now, because if we're given the option of walking into a restaurant, oh, where would you like to sit? She literally is rolling her eyes because she knows I'm going to pick a certain table in a certain position and I'm going to know where the exits are. It's just kind of, you know, built in. But so this is how it goes. Anyway, you'd plan this all out, you'd have it all sorted, you'd have pushed people ahead, there'd be people waiting for you to pick your tables, and then 10 minutes out on the way, the VIP would turn to the protection officer and go, do you know what, I think I'm gonna have a walk in the park first. Let's go down to this park here and we'll have a nice walk. So you'd be like, yeah, sure, no problems. Nothing was ever a problem. You were never like, no, we can't do that. We've pre-planned this, you know. So it had to be absolutely, you know, smile sweetly, you know, yes, no problems at all, so that's fine, you know. And then you're desperately trying to, you know, warn the team. So you'd be doing multiple clicks on your mic so that somebody would say, I'm getting multiple clicks. Is there a problem? Has the venue changed? One click for yes. You know, now there's this interrogation. Where are we going, you know? And it might be, you know, because you weren't really allowed to text either, you know, you might think that's easy. You might have had to sometimes, but That VIP needed to see calmness all around him or her and no dramas going on, you know, so that was what we would do. So this went on for 3 days. And every now and then we'd have people that we didn't know approach us because they'd been put up to it. They might have been family members of the instructors. Some would be difficult. And then normally at some point over the 3 days when we were out walking, when we were sat in a restaurant, when we were doing whatever, in a hotel lobby or something, an instructor or someone you didn't know perhaps would make, you know, an aggressive approach to your VIP and try and get close to them or try and, you know, pull them up on some perceived slight, you know, because they might have been, you know, a member of parliament or whatever in the sort of exercise brief, you know, so there'd be somebody who had an issue with them and you had to deal with that, you know, and this would happen a few times. But it was a really good sort of 3 days to finish up the course, thoroughly enjoyable. And then the final day, our VIP said, well, I want to go down and have a walk down onto, you know, this little village. There's a lovely village by the river. I'm going to go and meet someone in relation to what I'm dealing with. Because if I remember right, I think our VIP was actually someone who was under police protection because they were a witness. And I think they'd said, I need to go and check what's happening, you know, with this person. But they said specifically, I don't want loads of, you know, protection officers down with me. I just want me and my protection officer, no one else. And I don't want loads of cars down there and what have you. Now, this little place, it was a village in a cul-de-sac. So it was a one-way road. At the end of the road, there was a small village with a church, a village green, and about, you know, kind of 10 houses or something like that members of the public lived in. It wasn't a training scenario. It was the public arena. Some of us knew it. We pushed people down to have a look, and we decided that regardless of what the VIP said, we were going to put protection officers down there, but they were going to have to be very subtle, if not actually hide, because we knew we just couldn't get support in should there be an issue down at this place. And also being the sort of last day of the exercise, you know, it was very much in your mind that this could be a problem, you know, they're not going down here for no reason. So sure enough, I think I was the sort of second in command on the day. So the protection officer was going with him and I was tasked just to be off nearby, but very, very subtle, you know, sort of tucked away behind a wall or something. But we were all convinced that nothing too bad would happen because this was, you know, a public place. You know, there wasn't, you know, anything terrible going to happen down here. So we go down for the meet and there's a contact in the graveyard, our VIP goes up to speak to them. And when they get within, you know, sort of 20 or 30 yards, they say to the protection officer, well, look, I want to go and speak to them alone. So can you just wait here? So protection officer's like, yeah, fine. So he waits off. I'm in the wings. I think I was tucked behind a wall or a building or something. So I was just out of sight, but I was there. And we didn't have many other people down there because it was such a small, subtle place. You couldn't be dotting people around everywhere. So sure enough, he'd been talking to this person, his contact, for sort of 2 or 3 minutes. And to our absolute amazement, now we were all armed, but we were carrying blank rounds. There was no live ammunition anywhere. To our amazement, from 3 points around the churchyard at the same time, guys in camouflage jackets and balaclavas popped up with MP5 submachine guns on full auto, and basically started firing bursts of automatic fire towards our target. And then also stun grenades were thrown. You know, it was a full-on attack, which we couldn't believe, bearing in mind that it was, you know, a public place. But what we didn't know was that they used this venue all the time and that all the public there had been approached and were quite happy and, of course, actually quite interested and excited that this big police exercise was going to happen in their village. You know, they were quite used to it. So we responded as best we could, but, you know, we were massively outgunned. We called in support. One of our cars came screaming down the road. I returned fire with my, you know, pathetic blank round pistol to the three guys with automatic weapons. So did the protection officer, and we tried to scoot the VIP away and into the car. But at various points, we were joined by colleagues. And then instructors will walk around, you know, the hand of God, and they tap you on the shoulder and say, you've been hit in the leg, so you're wounded now, you know, and this is how it would go on. But it was utter chaos. It was a good way to finish up, but it was kind of bringing to the fore that, you know, absolute worst case scenario, this is what you could be facing. Fantastic course, really, really good course. There was a lot more to it, obviously. There was a lot of shooting, as you would imagine, in the range I'm talking about, a lot of very specialist shooting. So quite dangerous in some respects because you had to be able to you know, fire your weapon in very close proximity to the VIP and your colleagues, you know, without having a blue on blue and shooting one of your colleagues. You had to also be able to, you know, deal with all sorts of things and move and potentially give them body cover, fire with one hand and stuff. We did something in the range called walk in the box. So there was a box that was marked out with whatever was to hand, a chair, a fire extinguisher, whatever. And you had to walk this square in front of the targets in the range. And at various times, the targets would turn. Now, at the closest point, you might have been 5 meters away from the targets. And on the other hand, when you were furthest away, you might have been maybe 15 meters from the targets. But because you were walking the box, as we said, at one point you'd be tucked behind your VIP who would be ahead of you, and you'd be over their right shoulder, say, and behind them slightly, walking straight down towards the targets. Now, if a single target turned and was a threat, you would have to get in front of them, give them body cover, wrap your arm around the VIP whilst drawing your weapon and firing single-handed from the pistol. You know, something very against all sort of police training and shooting, you know, but this was specialist stuff. So that's what you did. And but that was the relatively easy one because at least you were facing the target. But of course, it was horrible. You'd turn left at the bottom of the box and you'd now walk parallel with the targets, and of course if they turned now, same thing, you had to draw and shoot whilst providing sort of side on quartering cover with your arm wrapped around your VIP, who would invariably struggle just to make it more difficult and realistic while you fired shots at the target. And then of course the worst one is when you turned away on the box, so now you're walking directly away from the targets, but you can't just leave your back to them, so you had to walk with your head sort of half turned towards the targets all the time. And again, if the targets turn, which of course invariably they did, you now had to basically go back to back with your VIP, wrap your arm around their waist to bring them tight into your body whilst drawing and shooting with your handgun. So very, very challenging shooting, you know, and I say totally against everything you'd really been taught up to this point, you know, but that's what it was. That's what it was about. You know, we also did a lot of driving and practice driving. So, as I say, we were all advanced drivers. So we were pretty good drivers, and most of us were TPAC. So we were used to, this was the tactical pursuit and containment TPAC. We were used to, you know, crashing into other cars deliberately and things. We'd all done quite a few hard strikes as SFOs. So this was, you know, physically bringing vehicles to a stop for an armed stop. You know, very aggressive. A thing that invariably involved us deliberately crashing our cars into people, you know, and this is how it progressed. So, but what we did on for our driver training was we went out to an old airfield that we had sort of carte blanche to use as we wanted, you know, massive wide roads effectively, you know, these were old runways, and I think it was a former sort of Second World War airbase, and we'd been down basically to the scrapyard. And we'd got ourselves about half a dozen really old, you know, sort of crappy cars with bald tires, you know, and gearboxes that didn't work and cracks in windscreens and what have you. And if they were drivable, they were and legal, because that was fairly important, obviously. We would drive them to the venue for the training. If they were that bad, they'd maybe be brought down on a trailer or a low loader and sort of offloaded at our training venue. And then we had, you know, sort of a series of days of training where we would practice, you know, sort of driving in formations, because these, you know, runways are obviously, you know, 1,000 meters long or whatever, so plenty of time to do this. There was a lot of obstacle courses set up, and we practiced and trained to drive with a blanket across the windscreen, for example. And this was to signify if a protester had thrown like a can of paint over your car and you were the VIP driver, obviously you now were blind effectively, you couldn't see through the windscreen. So we would train with the window rolled right down and basically us half up out of our seat and you know, looking out through the driver's window to actually see where you were going because the windscreen was completely blocked. So we did a fair bit of training around that, and there's ways around that. A lot of the cars are fitted with paint thinner, for example, in the windscreen washers, you know, so actually you can clear that quite well. But to be honest with you, if the windscreen was completely covered, we could still drive quite successfully like that. And then this is where the obstacle courses came in. As well as that, we would practice J turns and Y turns. So this would be where a threat presented, perhaps there was an ambush from the front, a vehicle approaching you front, and basically you'd have to reverse full power away from it, and then put on full lock effectively at speed, so the car was able to spin on its axis and then, you know, drive away very fast in the opposite direction. That was a J turn, a Y turn, a slightly different, where you do the same but back into a driveway or something like that to help you get away. So we had a few days of this. We also practice in America, I think they call it like the pit maneuver, where you're sort of deliberately crashing into cars, but it's a bit more technical than that. You know, there's certain places you have to hit cars depending on whether they're on bends or if you're driving straight, and where you hit the car, you can spin it off in front of you and things. I mean, I can't deny all of this wasn't pretty good fun, to be honest with you, but obviously with a serious undertone. And then towards the end of that course, the driving part of the course, the Prime Minister's car was brought down to us at the time, or one of his cars, and that was an armoured Jaguar. You know, so this thing looked like a relatively normal car, but as they all do, not quite on the scale of sort of the Beast from America, but it was an armoured car. You know, it could take kind of AK-47 rounds and RPGs fired straight at it. You know, these things have separate sort of air conditioning system, so if some sort of noxious gas was released, you were able to breathe freely inside. But this Jaguar, you know, weighed about 3 tons, you know, sort of double or treble what it should have weighed because of all the thick armor on the doors. And we all got a shot basically of driving this car to feel the difference, because they do handle differently. Very powerful engine, so they're still sort of quite capable cars. And actually the extra weight was useful in punching through other cars. You know, if there was like a roadblock, you could basically use this vehicle to smash your way out of it, because it was a really heavy, substantial car. But we also practiced J and Y turns in the PM's car, which I always found quite amusing. And we all imagined it would be a lot harder because of the extra weight. But if anything, it made it easier, because the extra weight helped you sort of spin round quicker. Excuse me. When you were turning. So the driving side of it was really, really good. And we did a lot of sort of hand-to-hand type combat, and not only a lot of weapon retention to make sure that we were able to keep hold of our own weapon should we get into a tussle with someone. But also really important was being able to get a weapon off somebody else, you know, if they were approaching you with a weapon, because you may not have time in a crowded situation to actually draw your own weapon. And we've seen that before. For example, Prince Charles was attacked way back, I think it was the 80s in maybe Hong Kong or somewhere, on the stage, and a man with a revolver approached him. I think he was firing the revolver at him. Well, the protection officer, you know, did exactly as he trained, and so did, you know, Prince Charles, now King Charles, in that he basically stood still and let his protection officer do what he should do, which was he gave body cover. He got in front of the prince. Now, he was criticised for why didn't he draw his own weapon and all that, but you have to remember there's a massive crowd of members of the public behind this guy. So what are you going to do? Draw your weapon and start firing blindly into this crowd? Can you imagine, you know, oh, well, we hit a couple of kids and we hit a pregnant woman, you know, and I actually missed the threat, you know. So sometimes it just isn't appropriate to draw your weapon. He gave body cover and he whisked the prince away exactly as he should have done, and relied on other members of the team to bring down the attacker, which is what happened. In an ideal world, the actual PPO, the protection officer, the personal protection officer, shouldn't be getting involved with the grappling and the tussling. Ideally, other members of the team should be stepping in to do that, allowing the PPO and the VIP to sort of extract themselves from the situation. I mean, you know, never say never, and that's the massive point about close protection. The golden rule is do something. In fact, there's two golden rules. One is do something. Anything is better than nothing. Don't just stand there like a rabbit in the headlights. You have to react. And the second one is, we're not a bag carrier. Because all the time you're carrying, you know, somebody's bag, you're not in a position to do your job. However, we will come on to that probably in the next episode now, because I see that the time is getting on. That's the position I found myself in on one of my first live jobs. So we'll talk about that in a bit. So we did a lot of unarmed training. And the other thing that was really put across to us, now we've already talked, and it might have surprised you that I said, you know, if you're receiving protection, if you're a celebrity and you're paying for protection, you don't expect to get attacked or stabbed. The reality is, like I said, that quite, you know, possibly might get through to you. That form of attack may get through to you, but it should be minimized massively. The scenario I explained earlier, you know, you might get stabbed once in the arm as opposed to 20 times in the chest. It sounds brutal, but that is the reality of it, you know. The other thing we were taught over and over again, and this again surprises people, is action will always beat a reaction. So, for example, if you're in a crowd and you're watching, your eyes are on stalks and you're watching everyone's demeanour, their face, their hands, what are they doing? Is the rest of the crowd waving flags and happy to see and cheering? You know, and there's just that one person in the crowd, sort of 10 people on from you, that, you know, is looking quite intense. They might be sweating even though it's cold. They just look like they're on a mission. They've got no flag. They're by themselves. You know, this is the sort of person that if you're a protection officer and you see them in the crowd, that would concern you. Now, you may well pass that on to the rest of the team and even get some of your officers to go and speak to them. You know, sometimes protection officers might just come and stand beside them. We have other people in the crowd playing other roles that might go and have a look at them. Or you might just go and speak to the uniform officer and say, there's a guy behind you, I'm not really happy about him. Can you just move 3 feet to your left? When the VIP comes, I want you standing directly in front of that person so they cannot get to them. But the point is, on this action reaction, the person who's going to do the bad thing, so he's going to draw the gun or he's going to draw the knife, they know when they're going to do that. You don't. So you're having to react to that action they've taken. Now, you will always be on the back foot. So this is what I said. There'll be 30 seconds where your brain is going, knife. There's a knife. There's a threat. I need to deal with it. Grab the knife. Grab the arm. You know, do something. Golden rule, do something. In that 30 seconds, they may have got to stab your VIP. And it was very much brought home to us where this action reaction, you would stand in front of one of your other pals on the course and they would be 21 feet away from you in distance. They would be given a rubber knife. You would have a training handgun in a holster and you would be told that that person is going to run at you and try and attack you with that rubber knife, a training knife. All you have to do is draw and shoot them before they get to you. And you'd be like, what? That's easy. I can do that all day long. Now, in fairness, occasionally you would be able to do this. But don't forget, this is a perfect scenario. You know the person's going to do something and your hand is literally like a gunslinger, sort of getting twitchy and getting ready to draw and shoot. So everything's perfect. Don't forget, if you're in a crowd and you've done this for weeks on an end and nothing has happened, when it suddenly does happen, your brain takes 10 seconds to catch up and go, threat, something's happening. So your pal charges at you with a rubber knife. You try and draw and shoot them on them. Now, chances are you are going to get to draw and shoot on them, probably. But don't forget, you're reacting to them running. And by the time your brain says threat, they're 10 feet away from you. By the time you actually draw and pull that trigger to fire at them, they've stabbed you once already. You've probably prevented the attack being worse, but they have got to you. And it really brought home just how, you know, switched on you have to be all the time. And that's why the sort of crowd situations were an absolute nightmare for a prot officer. You know, you say eyes on stalk, high alert beyond belief, you know. But we would look to very much plan those situations out by having officers around and moving officers subtly to block certain people getting between them. We could even speak to the VIP and go, should we just move on to the other side now? You know, if someone's meeting and greeting, you know, pressing the flesh, shaking hands and kissing babies and what have you, you know, they sort of flicked from side to side. So you might encourage them, should we just go over this side? Because there's some people over here perhaps you should see. Now, generally, it wasn't your role to do that, but the person would have been briefed. If your prot officer gives you a bit of a steer like that, take it, because they've seen or heard something that they don't like the look of and they're trying to prevent you. So we've now negated that threat completely just by being a little bit switched on. And this is what I was talking about. We don't have to put, you know, 10 muscle men in front of them to do the same job. It will do it, but it's not very subtle. So I think we're just over half an hour. We'll call a stop to it there. I've got some more talking about close protection next week, and we'll talk about some live jobs and some of the things that happened. So hopefully I've not rambled on too long and you found it interesting, but we'll come on to some more next week. In the meantime, you have a good week and I'll speak to you soon. Take it easy. Bye.